Welcome to Brain and Avat. We are delighted to be joined by Moti Gorin. And again, I have Holly Lawford-Smith as a special guest host. Moti, would you like to start with a thought experiment?
I'd like us to imagine a situation in which we take babies and we segregate them at birth by sex. So we take a bunch of female babies and put them over here, and we take a bunch of male babies and we put them over there, and we'll put aside the question of a tiny percentage of intersex babies. That's a separate issue. And then those male babies are raised by males, by men, adults who do their utmost, and they've been trained to reject any kind of traditional gender norms. And they're raised in the absence of any knowledge whatsoever about the other sex. And so they're geographically somewhat isolated. So they never encounter nor hear nor learn of the female sex. And the same goes for the female babies. They're raised in the absence of any males, in the absence of any gender norms, and so forth. And this goes on for some time. And we want to stipulate that the population of babies, both the males and females, is relatively large, so that they represent, they're representative of the diversity and variability of human beings generally, right? The only thing the male population is missing is the presence of females, and the only thing that the female population is missing is the presence of males. And then we want to ask ourselves, what forms of human diversity and variability would we see in these populations, right? And so we'd see variations in skin color. We would see variations in height. We would see variations in vulnerability to congenital illnesses and disabilities, and ranges, various ranges of intelligence, and so forth. And the question then is whether we would see, or the extent to which we might see, what is the extent to which we would see gender incongruent in these populations, where gender incongruence, as defined by the ICD-11 and many others, International Classification of Diseases, as a kind of mismatch or incongruence between one's sex on the one hand and one's internal sense of what sex or gender one is. And the strong intuition I have is that the rate of gender incongruence in these populations would be approximately 0%. And the idea is that this might show us something about the sense in which gender incongruence is a so-called natural part of human variability or human diversity. An alternative story, explanation of gender incongruence is that it's thoroughly social. It's social all the way down. And therefore, our approach to incongruence in the medical context in particular requires very careful thought.
Do you make a distinction between transsexuality and gender incongruence there? So would you countenance that we might expect to see some sex-based incongruence of the physiological kind, but not see anything that relates to gender expression, gender norms, the older distinction between transsexual and transgender identification? Or do you put everything, is your intuition that in these conditions of the thought experiment, we wouldn't see any of the spectrum of what we have called from transsexuality through to mere identification?
So my intuition is that we would see none across the board. That to have incongruence that would give rise to what used to be called transsexualism, what in the clinical context was called gender identity disorder, what is called today in the clinical context gender incongruence, we would see none of that in either of these populations.
So I wonder if you'd expect to see any variation of sexual orientation. So you've got totally sex-segregated societies, I assume that they have no concept of there being another sex. In other words, you just have the group of men who are raised among men, and you have the woman raised among women. So what range of sexual orientations would you expect there?
I think what we would probably see is, well, two things. One qualification is I'm thinking at least initially about what we would see among children, because we're going to be talking about pediatric gender medicine. So we're talking about children and then, you know, adolescents as these children go through puberty and so on. I think we would see a lot of same-sex sexual activity for reasons that should be pretty easy, I think, to discern. But I think we would still see what we might call homosexual dispositions or something like that, where, for example, some of the people might, without, they might not know they're happier about it than others, would be happier about it than others, right? And then if we brought these two islands together, there might be some aha moments among many of the people, at least over time. So I think we wouldn't call it homosexuality necessarily in this particular context, right? Because we wouldn't have the alternative concept. But I think we would still have gay kids and straight kids, right? Even though we would have exclusively gay sexual relations.
Here's my thought on that, is that the gay kids would seem the norm, right? In other words, those that engage in sexual conduct with each other because there is no other sex, that would seem like the norm. There'd be some set of kids who say, I don't want to do this. I find it disgusting and repugnant. I guess I'm asexual then. That would be their assumption, right? Until, as you say, the islands cross over and they go, oh, wow, I suddenly have this very strong desire to be with the people on that island. And so the difficulty I have is that it seems like because we've got this artificial setup that we wouldn't have a name for someone who was heterosexual, because there's just no way of manifesting being heterosexual. And you might similarly have someone who says, I just don't feel like all these other people on the island. They all seem like, you know, strong men, and they're manly, and I just don't feel that way. I don't know what I feel like, because I have no access to what this other sex could be, but I definitely don't feel like one of these people. So I wouldn't have a word for it. So I definitely wouldn't self-describe myself as trans or as a woman if I was on male island, but I also wouldn't describe myself as gay or straight, because there wouldn't be words for it. So I'm not sure that the experiment gives us any information about the world we live in.
The information it might give us is that on these islands, if that's what they are, while there are names for these dispositions, those dispositions would still be a feature of the people, right? And so my sense is that in the case of there would be gay kids, right? They wouldn't describe themselves as gay. Nobody would describe them as gay. But there would be gay kids, but there wouldn't be kids who had the property that we call gender incongruence. Of course, they wouldn't call it gender incongruence because they wouldn't have a concept of gender. But the question isn't whether they would have labels for them, but whether they would have the psychological characteristics that we label as such.
I think the intuitions that in this thought experiment are really going to track what I would call like difference feminism, but what, of course, if you're not a feminist, would just be like the extent of the reality of sex difference. Because I think if you really believe in biological or innate sex difference, and that explains a lot of what we see in the world today, you're going to think even in this segregated island thought experiment, most men are going to end up being masculine in the ways that that concept tends to get filled out now. Whereas if you're like more like closer to a sort of blank slate, or, you know, it's 5% innate and the rest is socialization, what you said, Moti, about the diversity, those positions in the spectrum are really going to be filled in, right? So for any female population, you should expect to see the full gamut from what we would call extremely masculine down to like what we would call extremely feminine and everything in between. And I think the intuitions are stronger that you would not have anything like, I'm not like them. So the thing that is gender incongruence, you just wouldn't have that if you had a well-filled out spectrum. But if it's true that males will tend to be masculine, of course, then it becomes more reasonable to think that like you could feel different from them, even if you didn't have a word for it yet. And that's the parallel to being asexual in the single sex society.
I think you would have all sorts of diversity in personality, with some of those personalities being what we would call more feminine, right? Yeah. Or more masculine. And for all we know, there some kind of cultural signifiers could develop around those personality differences that could end up being socially salient in some way, right? But what you wouldn't get, right? And so you would have people who felt different, and maybe those who were in the minority would feel not only different, but somehow wrong or perverse in some way. Maybe the very masculine one, we just don't know how, what would end up being sort of dominant and what would be the oppressed category. It's very difficult to predict that. So I think we would have those sorts of personality differences, right? And differences in virtue of those personality different self-conceptions in difference of the, in virtue of those personality differences. But what we're looking for when we're asking about gender incongruence, the claim is that there have always been gender incongruent kids, where gender incongruence is understood in a very, in some sense, technical way, right?
Yeah.
Where I am, people are moving away from this terminology, but in the wrong body in virtue of my sex characteristics.
Right.
That wouldn't exist, right? Is what is the intuition, at least.
Well, I can imagine someone growing up in the, you know, unisex society saying, I just feel so uncomfortable in this body that I'm in. Everyone else seems very comfortable in their bodies. I hate the fact that I'm growing this beard and I'm getting these erections, or, you know, or that I'm menstruating and I have breasts. I don't know why. I just feel this way. And then assume at some juncture, you know, we cross over into the other island, you know, turn a certain way, and you go, it dawns on me, I suddenly get it. I know why I felt this way. I've never had a language before. I've never understood why I was such an outsider. And now I have the realization. I'm assuming if that was what occurred, you would then go, okay, well, yes. I guess, you know, the those who have this gender disorder, it's somehow innate, right? But let's assume for the sake of argument that it's not innate. That's, you're 100% right, that you just never had anyone who claimed a gender case. But we do have it now, right? So in other words, in the world in which we live, there's various social conditions that make, let's assume that's doing 100% of the work. It's not innate. You've got various ways of being socialized that make people feel like they're born in the wrong bodies, or they want to be the other sex, and they want to take measures to be that way. And as I say, the topic of today is for kids. So the question is, let's assume it's social. Is that a reason to deny that person who feels very strongly about this, who might very well say, if I don't have this operation or go on these medication or, you know, dress a certain way or be treated in a certain way, I'm going to be absolutely miserable and maybe I'll kill myself. And I only feel this way because of the world that I happen to grow up in, and I wouldn't have if I grew up in, you know, Moti's unisex utopia. But this is the world I'm in, and this is how I feel. So what should we do about it?
Yeah, good. So, well, there were a lot of variables in that question. So, I think if it turns out that this phenomenon is social through and through, then we have to ask some preliminary questions about how we address discomfort, distress, unhappiness when it is socially when it's caused entirely through, you know, social forces. And we can ask ourselves about parallel cases, right? So it's just a fact of the matter, for example, that growing up gay in a homophobic society is much more difficult than growing up straight in a homophobic society. Growing up black in a racist society is much more difficult than growing up white in a racist society. Well, in a racist society where whites are the dominant class and so on. And in those cases, we generally don't jump to individualized medical care, right? We decry homophobia and we decry racism and we say we must change society. If you look for another area in bioethics where these sorts of issues come up, where they're very controversial, is in debates between, you know, certain utilitarians on the one hand and people in the disability rights community on the other hand, where there's a social model of disability saying that whatever welfare reductions we see on average among people who are disabled are really socially caused. And it's the responsibility of society to build ramps and pass regulations. And if we lived in a non-ableist society, we would not expect to see, and indeed would not see, reductions in welfare. Putting aside the separate question of whether those reductions are actually are accurate. In any case, so I think once we look at something as being sort of entirely or largely socially mediated, then we're having a different kind of discussion. So if you say, well, we should, if it turns out to be true that disabled people live worse lives on average in terms of their welfare levels, you could say, okay, well, we should select against them. Right? We should just go and do pre-implantation genetic screening, and we should select against people with disabilities. Go talk to people who are advocates of the disability rights position. They say, absolutely not, right? What we should be doing is building a society that is not ableist, and that would improve the welfare of people with disabilities. So on these islands, I'm imagining, we would have other forms of human diversity. We would have kids who were more predisposed to childhood cancer. And in those cases, it seems pretty obvious that we should intervene when we can to treat and, if possible, cure those cancers, because we don't think that cancer is social all the way down. Although, of course, social, where you live, how poor you are, et cetera, can impact your susceptibility to cancer. But there, medicalization looks like the obviously correct route to take. Not so in cases of race or sexual orientation or disability status, at least not obviously so. I don't see anybody advocating for skin whitening treatments, for example, to increase people's ability to pass in a racist society. The very proposal is sort of morally atrocious, right?
One thing that's super interesting here is that we have already given trans people, unlike gay people and unlike people with disabilities, this option of choosing to be like, so a trans man, a female person, can choose to be a normal boy or a unusual, trend-setting, path-breaking, whatever, girl. And we give her that choice. We have never given that choice to, there are people of color who have chosen to pass and take the kind of risks of doing that. But in general, we've never offered marginalized communities the option of being an ordinary X or an unusual Y. We've just said, hey, you're a gay kid, deal with bullying, it'll make you stronger. So I do think it's interesting that we're now in the moral position of, I gave this talk recently on whether it's morally wrong for for men to claim to be women. And I think it really came up in that context with the audience. Like, I want the trans woman to choose to live as an unusual man. I want him, for feminist reasons, to choose to be like just a fun man or a cross-dresser or to say, this is how I want to present myself and live, but I am not a woman. But I think we should take seriously that, like, given that we have offered the trans community this option of crossing over, passing, blending in, and just being a perfectly ordinary person who meets no friction, if they can meet that standard, that we are then asking something quite extraordinary of them when we tell them not to do that, because we're asking them to be like moral trendsetters or to take on this moral obligation that other people in society aren't taking on. So what do you think about that disanalogy with racism and sexual orientation and disability?
Well, one explanation for that might be that in one case, the trans case, we have means, right, to allow for an assimilationist approach. There are so-called conversion therapies. They don't work. They're really harmful. But if, you know, we can imagine a world in which we develop some kind of effective conversion therapy in the form of, hormonal treatments, right? Or something like that, or a magic pill. And then we would have a question, right? Should we offer these pills to young gay kids, say, right? Yeah. And then you end up, there's an interesting problem here. It comes up again in the disability rights literature, where from the perspective of trying to maximize the welfare of the child, you might be inclined, as let's say a parent, to say, look, it's not our fault that we live in this viciously homophobic society, right? Where the life prospects of this person, my child, are going to be significantly harmed, right? Because we live in a homophobic, I might be tempted then to give my kid this pill, not because mm-hmm. I'm homophobic, but because mm-hmm. I care about maximizing and protecting the interests of my child in this unjust scenario, right?
Right.
Just as you might, I mean, there were Jews who hid their Judaism and who raised their children to be Christians in anti-Semitic society. And the way we think of those situations is we think, well, of course they did what they had to do to survive, but we don't celebrate it. And we don't, and we point to the background conditions that made this kind of assimilation morally required, and in this case, morally permissible, and perhaps morally obligatory if you need to save your child's life. Now, in the case of children who are transitioning, we aren't asking, at least many people aren't asking, a lot of questions about the background conditions that make. So let me put this another way. This is a question I haven't seen asked, and it's, I'm not quite sure how to ask it, and I haven't thought about it too much. But let us suppose, and we'll talk about the evidence in a little bit, but let us suppose that it turns out to be true, right? Contra the evidence, but it's true that if you take a gender nonconforming child or adolescent who is struggling with their sex body and you provide them with some medical intervention, let's just grant that they flourish, their health improves, morbidity goes down, and they flourish. Let's suppose that's true. You might think that's wonderful, we should do this. But you might ask a sort of preliminary question, which is to ask, what does that tell us about our society, right? That doing this to one's body actually improves your welfare. What kind of social conditions are we in such that lifelong hormonal dependency, pretty serious surgery with a fairly high complication rate, et cetera, actually makes you better off? What must be true of the society such that an individual ends up better off going through this process, right? And I think that's a sort of very difficult question to answer, and actually difficult to sort of formulate in an especially clear way.
So Jonathan Haidt writes about bad advice that you can give a child in The Coddling of the American Mind, which is that we should prepare the road for the child instead of preparing the child for the road. And it seems that your position is this. Our society is so bad that the only way that some people can, you know, live in it is to go through a medical method. So instead, we should radically change our society. So that seems to be preparing the road for the child instead of saying, look, you know, this is the world we live in. I should enable my kid to have the best possible chance at it. And the idea of saying I should instead rail against reality and instead of enabling my kid to have the best possible chance in the world they live in, that seems, you know, it seems asking too much. You might think, for example, that if you live in a very homophobic society and your kid is gay, that's, you know, it would be better to not live in that homophobic society. But if your kid is going to get killed for being gay, then you might at least want to give them some options about how to pass. And that's, you know, to lead a secret life so they don't wind up dead. I imagine, for example, if you're a gay Palestinian who lives in Gaza, that the best possible thing you can do to ensure your survival is to pretend that you're not gay and to live a secret life. It'd be much better, of course, to live, you know, across the corridor in Israel where no one's going to kill you because you're gay. But there are a couple of things that you've said that are just so delightful that I really want to go into more detail. So the one is the disability rights movement's claims, and I suppose the most famous version of that is Elizabeth Barnes' mere difference view, right? So there isn't anything good or bad about being disabled. It's just different. And that's why we should say society must radically change itself so that everybody can lead the life they want to live. I just wonder how plausible that view really is. It seems like if you're born with no eyes and no legs and no ears and your flesh feels like it's on fire every day, that there's not much society can really do. You just are actually worse off. And that it maybe it's nice to pretend that you're the same as everybody else and it's just different, but that seems deranged to me. It might be, as you point out, that disability advocates have a hard time squaring their positions with, let's say, the trans movement positions, that there might be an incompatibility there. But I'm not so sure the rest of us who are sensible have to bite that bullet. The other one is on what do we do with the person who wants to change race? And of course, Rebecca Tovell, written a famous paper in defense of transracialism. And imagine you have a kid who says, look, I just feel really, really uncomfortable in the race that I'm in. I hate it. I feel this massive trauma, and I'd like to take steps to change it. Is it that bad? What's the problem? Why should we think that this person is an outcast or a liar or a cheat or, you know, doing some bad thing? My general framework is one of personal choice seems to matter quite a lot. If you're not harming anybody else, we should, you know, let you swing your fist as far as you can as long as you don't bop me on the nose. We tend to think that kids are a separate case because we don't want them to make dumb choices that they have to live with when they're not in a situation where they can really make a choice. So if my 5-year-old kid says to me, you know, daddy, I want to be a unicorn, and so please take me to the surgeon so you can, you know, put the unicorn thing in my head, I might want to say, maybe you're not going to feel that way by the time you're 12. And so we'll get you a little unicorn cone for now, but, you know, we'll hold off on the surgery. Some things might be reversible. But I imagine if you're a 30-year-old and you want the unicorn put in your head, well, go for it. If you want to change your race, go for it. If you want to change your sex, sure, why not?
I don't have strong views on transracialism. I'm not sure what to say there. About whether it should be acceptable socially for people to be treated as whatever race they claim. I mean, I think there are sort of difficult questions and considerations on both sides there. What I will say is that if transracialism required the same kind of medical interventions that had a similar risk-benefit profile to the medical interventions that we're thinking about when we think about pediatric gender medicine, then I would raise serious objections to transracialism, right? It's one thing to say, look at me, I would like to be treated as if I'm a member of this race or that race, and then we can talk about what that would mean. But if I were to say, well, I'm 12 years old, and in order for me to achieve or realize my true racial identity, I need to, have medical procedures that are risky, irreversible, et cetera, then, and that didn't even really convincingly change my racial appearance, whatever that might mean, right, then I think we would be asking the kinds of questions that we're asking about pediatric gender medicine. So there are like general questions like, should people be allowed to identify as this or that group? And there's all kinds of interesting ethical and social questions there. But then when you introduce kind of medical risk and you're asking medical professionals, right, to do particular things that may or may not accord with their professional ethical duties, right, then we're in, I think, we're asking a different set of questions than just these sort of general questions about accepting people based on their identity.
I think we should get on to talking more about the medical risk, but maybe just before we do that, just to kind of push a little more on the kind of moral reasons not to support transracialism, and which I think cross over into the transgender case, right? Like just that people care a lot about the dynamics of oppressor slash oppressed, or whatever you want to call that, dominant slash subordinated. There would be a lot of things to say on behalf of the person who really cares about racial dynamics for why we don't think it's just a like laissez-faire, let the white man be a Nigerian woman if he wants to, right? Or like let the white person claim to be whichever. I mean, this is like, I guess, part of contemporary identity politics, that we're sort of pushing people to identify with the groups that have given them some sorts of benefits or privileges, and then we want this kind of reckoning with history on that basis. And there's lots of things to say about what's wrong with that approach. But I guess as someone who feels quite strongly about that approach in the context of feminism, that there is some reason for men to take seriously that they should not just claim to be women, because that is a member of a oppressor group on the dimension of sex, not all things considered, and that's just a separate argument for another time, but on the dimension of sex, that is an oppressor claiming to be the oppressed, and there's like a lot to say about why that is objectionable. I mean, I don't know if you want to add anything to that, but I'm just flagging one thing is the medical risks, but there is a whole other thing that is even right. just the moral considerations separate of that.
Sure. I mean, the particular oppressor-oppressed relations that you have in mind for feminist reasons have to do with males claiming to be women. And yeah. one way that we could sort of skirt that issue a little bit is by limiting the discussion. I mean, what's going on in the case of females claiming to be men, right, with trans. Now, we can, there are, I think, plausible explanations for why adolescent girls might have an interest in claiming to be boys. And we see from talking to the girls who transition what some of those reasons are. But I think there it's not just a simple, an oppressive, members of an oppressive class just doing whatever they want for reasons of entitlement. It's a bit more complicated. It's related to that, right? It's like, you might have an interest in being a member of a class that is the oppressive class, because it's better than being a member of the oppressed class. But yeah. it goes, the route is a little more complex.
Good. That's helpful. Okay, let's go on to the sort of medical risks issue in a bit more detail. So I wanted to ask yeah. you, maybe just as a place to start, about the kind of state of knowledge or the literature in this area. Obviously, the two sides to the debate, the pro-gender-affirming care for children and the anti, and the people who think we should at least wait till they're 18 and maybe 25 and maybe never. There's really a war here about what has been established. Yeah. And I guess particularly with reference to like puberty blockers and cross-sex hormones as the medical treatment of trans children. So can you just tell us something, your impression of the state of the literature and where things are at would be great.
Right. So there are diverging views, I guess we could say. And it's a very interesting phenomenon. I've been following this area closely for the last few years and working on it. And what you see is on one side of the debate, people who are the strong advocates for medical transition of youth claim that these are evidence-based treatments. They claim that there is a medical consensus. In the United States, where I live, all of the major medical organizations strongly endorse medicalized gender transition for youth. So the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association, and then you have dozens of groups that defer to them, right? So you'll get these lists of, look at all these groups that support this, and most of them don't work in this area. They defer to the experts or the perceived experts, which is perfectly acceptable in most cases. And they will, advocates will point to studies. There have been studies done for the last 30 years or so on the effects on mental health on children who are suffering from gender dysphoria and other mental health problems that arguably arise from their gender incongruence. Over the last 5 years or so, we are in a better position. We've gotten to be in a better position. And the way we've gotten to be in a better position with respect to the evidence is due to something called a systematic review of the evidence, evidence grading. And so when you read a think piece in Slate or wherever, and somebody will claim that these interventions are evidence-based, and what they mean, they're speaking kind of loosely. They mean there's some study somewhere or some that suggests that these are effective. Evidence-based in the technical sense, in the evidence-based medicine sense, it has a technical meaning. Evidence-based medicine requires that clinical recommendations for what intervention to use or not use be based on the best available clinical evidence. Best available. Well, how do you know what is best available? You do what's called a systematic review. And so you define your search, the first step, right? You define your search. We want to know how cross-sex hormones impact gender dysphoria, depression, anxiety, suicidality, let's say. And you search for everything that's ever been written, all the studies that have been done that meet those criteria. A team of methodologists look at those studies and they grade them, right? Some studies are stronger than other studies. And so if you're looking at like one case report, right, that's very, very weak evidence. If you look at a double-blind, placebo-controlled study with a large N, right, large population, that's a much stronger form of evidence. And then you give a grade. So the evidence is very uncertain, uncertain. I can't remember exactly what the different ratings are, but you get the point. There's a scale. And from there, you base your recommendations. And we have now a small handful of systematic reviews. The Finns in Finland, they conducted a systematic review. The UK, NHS England conducted a systematic review. The Swedes conducted a systematic review. And they looked at all the available evidence and they graded it. And what these countries concluded is that the evidence is uncertain or very uncertain, that these interventions do what the studies sought out to determine they do with respect to the benefits, right? So evidence that blockers and hormones improve mental health is very uncertain. This is what we're hearing from Swedish authorities, Finnish authorities, and British authorities. And so there's evidence and there's evidence, right? There's studies showing all kinds of things. There's studies showing, many, many different things. But you have to look at the actual study and you have to grade it. So you have on the one hand, a group of methodologists and clinicians, doctors saying, look, we really don't know whether these are effective based on the highest, if you look at the evidence pyramid, systematic reviews are at the top. And then you have the United States and elsewhere people saying, actually, the evidence is really overwhelming that these are very effective. And so it's a very kind of perplexing environment where there are major differences in how leading health authorities from developed countries, what conclusions they're drawing about these interventions. It's a very strange situation.
Is your sense that, like, this is all the disagreement over what the evidence is and what it shows is kind of well-meaning and explicable within normal practice? Or is your sense that, like, this has actually become so politicized that the normal processes have broken down?
Both. It depends on who you're asking this question of. So if you go and talk to your average pediatric endocrinologist at a gender clinic in Seattle or Los Angeles or Portland, they'll say, they'll point to the studies and I can tell you which studies they'll point to. And they legitimately probably believe that these are really effective life-saving interventions. Mm-hmm. That being said, there is a completely independent strain of thought in support of these interventions that does not appeal to medical benefit at all. These are autonomy-based, to transition as a human right. And some of those people lean on the studies for more or less pragmatic reasons. And I can give you a very clear example of this. So in order to get a prescription for puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones, you have to have a formal diagnosis in the United States of gender dysphoria, right? Then because that's a pathology, it's a mental disorder, and insurance companies will come in and pay for that. Now, when the International Classification of Diseases was thinking about what to do about gender dysphoria, and there's a paper by Drescher and other leading figures, they want the activist groups that they were talking to want to depathologize transness. This is a normal human variability, normal human diversity. just as we depathologize homosexuality, we need to depathologize being trans. And they wrote this paper where they say, well, we on the one hand, we want to depathologize. This is just normal human variability. On the other hand, someone has to pay for this. We need a diagnosis. So what they did is they found a kind of middle ground. It's not really middle ground. They found a third way. They got rid of gender dysphoria in the ICD. They replaced it with gender incongruence. Gender incongruence is a mismatch between your felt or experienced gender on the one hand and the sex you were assigned at birth on the other. And they moved that diagnosis out of the mental disorder category because they don't think that people who are trans should be thought of as being mentally disordered. And they moved it into a new chapter on what they called conditions related to sexual health. So there's this fundamental tension between, on the one hand, saying there's nothing wrong with people who have gender incongruence. On the other hand, saying, but they need all this expensive medical care and we have to have it paid for. So on the one hand, you've got clinicians and researchers doing empirical studies on the effects of these interventions on mental and physical health. On the other hand, you have people saying, irrespective of what the mental health improvements are or not, these interventions should be available because, well, just because we want them, because we have an autonomy right to transition. And I think sometimes the autonomy-based arguments sometimes people appeal to the clinical arguments as a vehicle, right, for what they really believe, which is an autonomy-based argument, because it has to be paid for, right? The alternative is to bring these interventions out of the clinic and regulate cross-sex hormones in the same way that we regulate tobacco, marijuana, alcohol. Why are doctors involved at all? And we could do that as a society if we decided. But today, it's doctors who are doing this. And so doctors have to do what doctors do, which is give a kind of clinical justification. That was a long answer to maybe your question. I'm not sure if I answered your question, Molly.
So a couple of wonderful things to think about there. The one is that we're dealing with uncertainty regarding efficacy. And I imagine that is not a unique problem. In other areas where someone has some disease and we think about whether we should treat it through surgical intervention, we don't know whether it's going to work. It might be that the side effects are worse. Recently, I went to my doctor and I said to him, you know, I'm getting to a certain age. Should I be getting a screening test for prostate cancer? And he said to me, it's a very contentious subject. And I was surprised. He said, well, I'll tell you why. He says, a lot of people die with prostate cancer. A lot of them don't die from prostate cancer. So a lot of people will have it. If you detect it in them, they will freak out and they will think that they need to have a surgery and have it removed. And there are serious side effects, which are incontinence and erectile dysfunction and pain, and it's very expensive. And it might be that it was totally and utterly unnecessary. And so the standards about whether or not we should do, you know, regular screenings are debated as to whether it's a good idea or not, because you could get these different reactions from people. And you might think the same, that if, let's say, you made every kid answer a little questionnaire and you said, hey, maybe you have gender dysphoria and we should take you down a medical route, that it's the kind of thing that, you know, the medical establishment is pushing you down a road that you might not have gone down on your own. And similarly, there might be other forces that are pushing you down that road that you wouldn't have gone down. But I thought it's worth disambiguating a few things. So let's look at the autonomy argument. And let's look at it from the perspective of people who actually are autonomous. So you're an adult and you are not asking other people to subsidize your choices. So if I want to dress in a glitter outfit and it costs $10,000, I have no right to expect anybody else to pay for it, regardless of how fucking delighted I'll be dancing around in this outfit. And you might think the same about someone who says they want to transition. You say, go right ahead. I'm not paying for it. So that's the one view that I think seems sensible to me, to say it's your choice. If you want to make a bad choice, if you want to have to revise that choice, well, it's your body and we shouldn't be here to prevent that. Mm-hmm. Again, you want to nail the horn to your head and call yourself a unicorn, have at it. You know, if I think you really are autonomous. Now, we don't want a situation where it's a catch-22. We say anybody who would ever have such a desire that's so abnormal must necessarily be insane, and so we won't respect their choices. You know, you got to have some kind of standard where you can work out, is this person a sensible person generally? Now, if we're in the question about would this be a useful medical treatment, and we don't know, so we say, well, it's unclear. Maybe this is going to prevent some kid from killing themselves if we give them this treatment. Maybe it'll have no effect whatsoever. Maybe they'll grow up in the different sex, but you know, that's how they go, and you know, they don't look back. Maybe they feel immense amounts of regret. We've got this risk problem. How do we balance that? So if there are certain possible benefits and certain possible side effects, how do we make that choice when you're dealing with a child who's not autonomous or not fully autonomous?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And these are the sorts of trade-offs that clinical guidelines have to navigate. And there's the sort of trade-offs that clinicians have to navigate and patients and their families. So I think you've overstated the uncertainty on one side and understated it on the other side to some extent. So we know, for example, that with pediatric medical transition, there are costs. There are physical costs to that transition. It's so if you follow the Dutch protocol to the letter, the original protocol on which much of this medicine has been based starts at Tanner stage 2 of puberty, very early puberty, and you introduce puberty blockers. Sometime after that, it can be a short period of time. It can be 2 or 3 years. People can't stay on blockers indefinitely. That's thought to be harmful for bone development at that age. In any case, you move on from blockers to cross-sex hormones. And then at the age of maturity in some countries, although WPATH doesn't have any age restrictions on genital surgery, with the exception of phalloplasty. But in any case, it's a three-step process. That is guaranteed 100% of the time to lead to sterility. Okay, it is 100% of the time going to lead to at least risk of certain medical harms, such as various harms that can attend surgery, just the usual surgical harms. It leads to sexual dysfunction. So Marcy Bowers, the head of WPATH, was doing some online workshop, and she said, and this was, you know, shared on Twitter or whatever a while back, maybe a year and a half ago, something like that, saying that, you know, she's seen many kids through this process, that she was unaware of a single boy, a male patient of hers, who had puberty blocked at 10 or 2, went on to cross-sex hormones, who was able to achieve an orgasm. So those are harms that we have. And then there are harms with bone density. There are unknown harms having to do with cognitive development. It's thought that puberty is a kind of window. And if that window closes, right, there are possible cognitive effects. This is understudied. Some people, I think, are trying to study it. In any case, that's just to say that our confidence in certain harms is pretty high. The confidence that we have in benefits is lower than that. So I think just, you know, when you look at, you're doing a cost-benefit analysis, it has to be favorable before that intervention is offered to a patient. Once you've established that the cost-benefit is favorable, then you leave it up. Then the question of consent arises. Can the kid consent? Can the parent consent? And the kid assent? Consent issue arises only after clinicians have established that there's a favorable risk-benefit profile. A child cannot consent. The question of consent does not arise. If a child goes into the pediatrician and says, you know, I would like chemotherapy. Do you have cancer? Do you have any reason to believe you have cancer? No. I just want to be hairless. Aesthetically, that's what I prefer. The doctors aren't going to then ask, is this kid mature enough to make a decision? What the doctors are going to say is chemotherapy has serious harms. There's no benefit to you here. It's not on the table. The question isn't, can you consent? The question is, can we offer it in the first place? And what I'm suggesting is that the current state of the evidence doesn't justify the offering of these interventions. When you look, for example, the strongest or the emotionally strongest argument that advocates of these interventions give is that it prevents suicide. And you mentioned this, Mark. You hear over and over from, you know, first-person accounts of families going in with their kid who's struggling and the physicians telling them, well, would you rather have a dead son or a living daughter? And you see over and over in think pieces and elsewhere, actually the high-level health authorities, members of the Biden administration call this life-saving care. When you actually look at the evidence, right, for these interventions preventing suicide, it's just not there. Just a few weeks ago, 2 weeks ago maybe, Rita Kaltiala and Finland and their team did a large study. They have the benefit of having a sane healthcare system in Finland. They have a health registry. They can look at all the patients, right? They can collect all this data. And they looked at rates of completed suicide among kids who were referred to gender clinics. And it was uncommon. It was like 0.3%, okay? It was higher relative to matched controls. So it looked like kids who are distressed about their gender do complete suicide at higher rates. However, they then controlled for psychiatric morbidity among the matched controls and found that the rate is no longer elevated. In other words, if you're having psychological problems, certain kinds of acute psychological problems, you're more likely to kill yourself. And that's true whether or not you also have this gender confusion or you're claiming a transgender identity, right? And this has really important implications for the way we treat these children, because what Hillary Cass and the Cass interim Cass report called, what she pointed to, what the report pointed to, was a phenomenon known as diagnostic overshadowing, where a kid comes in, they have all these problems. As soon as the word gender comes up, they ship them off to a gender clinic and everything becomes identity-based and all the problems are filtered through this lens. So it's the identity, and what we need to do is we need to affirm, and then we need to give them these interventions or they're going to kill themselves. And the other psychiatric or neurodevelopmental challenges are just ignored. And this is one of the reasons the Finns have sort of stepped back, is because they noticed, they opened their clinic in 2011 and started noticing that the kids that they were treating weren't getting any better on all these other measures. They weren't functioning better, right? Their trips to psychiatric facilities weren't going down. They weren't doing the things that quote unquote normal teenagers are expected to do in terms of their relationships, their romances, their schoolwork. They just weren't getting better. And so it looks like that those sort of gender interventions are just running in neutral with respect to psychiatric problems.
Can I just ask, do you think this is a point that both sides could actually agree on? So even if you think there are trans children, or you think that really no child who claims to be trans really is trans, both sides could agree that like there are other things going on, possibly, so that child could be gay. There could be these comorbidities like depression or bipolar disorder or what, you know, there's a whole list of things that are known comorbidities. So is that a point where there's some hope for convergence on what needs to be happening in this space? Because we could all agree that like we need to at least make sure we're getting it right, whether the thing that needs to be treated is transness. And we could just maybe set aside this question of whether there's any such thing as a trans child.
Right. So there is a more reasonable position, which is the following. Kids come in, they have a really complicated psychiatric histories. Their problems are complex. One of their problems is gender related. Okay. So what we need to do is we need to treat all these problems and also affirm, right? That's one kind of position, which is the affirmation piece is one piece of their sort of psychiatric picture. Mm-hmm. And we don't want to overshadow. We want to make sure that we're addressing the whole person, right? And holistic care. But what you see more often, and this is what was reported in Hannah Barnes' book, and if you talk to clinicians and you read some of the papers, what ends up happening with some of the most, I don't know what to call them, aggressive affirmers or something like that, is the other problems are thought to be caused by the gender problem, right? So if we solve the identity issue, if we transition this kid medically, all these other problems will be solved. And indeed, that's what the kids are hoping for, and that's what the families are hoping for. You've even had clinicians claim that autistic traits might be ameliorated through transition, right? So it's not, you can imagine somebody saying, I don't want to reduce everything to gender dysphoria and gender incongruence. These kids are complex. Let's do it all very carefully. But what you see too much in actual practice is all those other problems, right, are construed as sequelae of gender dysphoria or gender incongruence.
But does this suggest to you that there could not be affirmation compatible with taking those other things seriously, that we could only have something like watchful waiting? I'm not going to affirm you, but I'm also not going to like conversion you. I'm just going to say, maybe you are, maybe you aren't. Let's see. Is that where you land? Or do you think there's a way to responsibly kind of socially affirm while taking very seriously these other issues?
So what the, so there's different clinical approaches. The original Dutch studies by De Vries and her colleagues, the 2011, 2014 papers, those kids, they excluded kids with psychiatric comorbidities. What they said is, we're about to embark on an experiment. We're going to block these kids at Tanner 2, cross-sex hormone surgery. We want to make sure that the psychiatric comorbidities aren't really what's going on, and we want to just focus on the gender distress, right? In Finland and in Sweden and now in the UK, I think the final CAS report is expected relatively soon. They seem to be taking a similar approach. These kids are coming in with really complex histories. It would be irresponsible to give a kid with four diagnoses, a history of sexual trauma, overt internalized homophobia. It would be irresponsible as a clinician to put this kid on cross-sex hormones right now. Let's do psychosocial interventions, psychiatric treatment, holistic care. And then if down the road they're generally stable and healthy and they still want to transition, then we can talk about that. So that's the approach that the Scandinavians seem to be adopting. And I think that's probably the right approach, because I think that when you're talking about questions of identity, who am I, do I want to engage in, or do I want to sort of opt for these irreversible, serious medical interventions, you want to make sure that those, that kind of distress isn't caused by, right, or naively explained by, according to the patient themselves, by these other problems. You have kids, you know, you have, you know, the Tavistock Clinic, other clinics have reported something like 30% of the patients they see have moderate to high autistic traits. Mm-hmm. That's a really high percentage, right? So, well, what's going on there? And there's people working on this question. One thing that is plausibly going on is these kids feel different because they're neurocognitively, they're neurodiverse, they're different. They get excluded in certain ways. And then there's a narrative that's presented to them online or wherever that the reason they're excluded, the reason they're rejected by their peers, the reason they don't fit in socially is because they're in the wrong body and all they need to do is transition. So you want to make sure that that's not the reason that somebody wants to transition before you remove their breasts. I mean, that just seems like a no-brainer.
Yeah.
Right. But then there are people who say, well, autism isn't a counterindication for transition. And so there have been at the WPATH conference, affirming clinicians talking about their struggles with how to affirm a nonverbal autistic child. And so they're talking about doing things by letting them do drawings. So they can't consent verbally because they're nonverbal. Oh, we'll just have them draw a picture of like the kind of body they want. And that's them expressing their gender identity. I mean, so you get to that level of, I don't know, lack of a better word, batshit insanity.
I looked briefly into the literature about the correlations between autism and trans identification, and I came across some of the most wild possible, like, speculative explanations. And I think the silliest one was, in my opinion, that autistic people tend to feel sensations, like their phenomenology is stronger relative to, like, non-autistic people. And that's why the idea was, like, autistic boys will like the feeling of silky fabrics next to their skin. Women's clothes are more silky than men's. So it's supposed to be, and it's like a complete, like, wait, so that's an explanation of autistic boys identifying as women, but that's not an explanation of autistic girls identifying as boys. It was just crazy. It was like this totally limited, like, it couldn't explain the whole pool at all, but it was just this, like, oh, here's a thing that autistic people are like that might, yeah, it just really seemed low quality.
And of course, now, you know, the fastest growing population are the adolescent females, the adolescent girls. So that wouldn't even be an explanation, even if it were plausible, which it's not. That wouldn't even be an explanation for the so-called new cohort that we've been seeing since the mid 2010s or so.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
So I wonder if you think there ought to be different protocols for boys who want to become girls and girls who want to become boys. And so I think there might be some reason to think that you should have different barriers. So the one is, I suppose, how important is it that if you're going to transition medically, that you pass as the other sex, and whether it matters when you transition. So I gather that if you become a trans man, that you're going to pass quite well. You're going to look short. But you're going to pass as a man. A lot of people are going to be quite surprised that you were, you know, born as a woman. If you want to be a trans woman, it might make a difference if you do that at a young age before you hit puberty to pass. And the passing might make a big difference for how your life goes. In other words, if you don't want to be considered trans, you just want to be considered a man or a woman, and you want to be treated like that, and you want to lead a life free from persecution, that seems like something that helps. The other one is, as you say, in the young girls case, that you've had this huge spike in numbers. And there's this quite contentious article about, a girl in a group says, you know what, I had a revelation, which is that I'm a young boy. And 2 weeks later, all the other friends in the group go, me too. I also like the Backstreet Boys, and I'm a boy. Isn't that amazing? And that seems like a reason to say, okay, maybe this is, you know, an adaptive preference that isn't one that's going to persist for very long, and so we should make it harder. Do you think it makes sense to have these different protocols?
The short answer is no, because I think, again, when we go back to thinking about risk-benefit profiles, they don't work out in either case. But I think that the argument for delaying transition among females is stronger for the reasons you gave, namely that insofar as passing matters, it's easier for trans men to pass than it is for trans women. And in fact, when you read the papers from the Dutch researchers who developed this protocol from the 90s, one of the reasons they offer for introducing blockers was exactly this. They had been studying and working with adult trans women, and they found that even after medical transition, psychopathology remained fairly high. So suicide rates were still high. Social lives weren't always going very well. And one of the reasons, it was hypothesized, they're just not passing well enough. And then, right, puberty blockers had been starting to be prescribed in the 80s for precocious puberty, and a light bulb went off, and they said, well, wait a minute, what if we can avoid, right, the acquisition of sex characteristics entirely, right? What if we can make these kids pass better via puberty blockade? So that kind of thinking applies much more strongly to trans women than it does to trans men for the reasons you gave. So I think the reasons we have to be really skeptical of these interventions apply in both cases, but I think they apply more strongly in the case of natal females, both because it's easier for them to pass later and because we have reason to believe that the rapid increase in rates of these people presenting is some kind of social phenomenon.
As we know, like there's a lot of different people attracted to this area of talking about trans identification and gender affirming care and so on. So I guess one question would be like, are you the alt-right? And if not, what's your interest in this area? How are you primarily one of the free speech guys, one of the feminists, one of the, what's bringing you here? What's your angle?
Well, I mean, the reason I've been thinking about these issues is because I'm a you know, philosophy professor and a bioethicist, and there are really interesting and I think important philosophical questions, and I think many of the questions that sort of permeate this field are could be well answered or engaged with by philosophers. And as a bioethicist, this is an extremely contentious issue where you've got all, you know, many, many bioethics themes and questions sort of are wrapped up in this particular problem. So that's why I'm working on it. In terms of my politics, I'm far left, I guess, is what I would say. Okay. And one very strange thing, and I've talked to other people, other sort of leftists who have similar concerns, is you end up feeling a bit politically isolated because people just assume, partly for strategic reasons, it's really easy to just label somebody a right-wing fanatic and kind of be done with them. And that's the way that the discussion takes place broadly and certainly in the United States. Mm-hmm. And it's very difficult to make one's case without sounding like a conspiracy theorist or a right-wing lunatic. And if you talk to your average liberal fence sitter about these issues, they're not following this closely. Half of them don't know what a trans woman is. They're like, isn't that just a man who wears, like, they don't even know the trans woman is some kind of a woman, like a female, but like, in any case, so they're kind of aware of this stuff because it percolates up into the media. But then, you know, if you ask someone what their position is, they are going to do what we all do when we don't look into a matter directly, which is defer to trusted experts. Yeah. And so if you're an American liberal and somebody asks you, what do you think about pediatric gender medicine? Who are you going to trust, the ACLU or Donald Trump? Well, of course, if you're rational, you're gonna appeal to what the ACLU says. Now, it happens that the ACLU print stuff that's false all the time about this issue, right? Yeah. But in order to figure that out, you have to read all these scientific papers, and you have to go to conferences, and you have to learn what evidence-based medicine is and what clinical guidelines are, and you have to look at the larger culture and understand how certain elite institutions have been captured and so on. And that's where the conspiracy theorist part comes in, right? So to answer your question, I'm definitely a leftist on all matters, right? And in fact, I think this is a point that Jamie Reed makes, who's the whistleblower at the St. Louis Gender Clinic. She was, living in anarchist collectives. She's a sort of leftist, right? Grew up on like Noam Chomsky and Howard Zinn and all this. And she's saying that the left has kind of lost its way with respect to this issue. And when you think about it, this kind of individualized medicine-based solution to these social problems is not something that you would identify typically with the left. This consumerist, right, go out and buy some breasts, right? Mm-hmm. Go out and change your body. Think about what like the left perspective is on plastic surgery, say. What would the leftists say, generally speaking, about breast augmentation and things like that, that you just, go out and pay a plastic surgeon to change your body to better conform with these oppressive gender roles. They would, be highly critical of that. But in this case,
I don't know if that's true anymore. I mean, I see what you're saying, but I guess I'm thinking there has just been this big shift, partly in, maybe this is just coming from feminism, like the left thinks it owns minorities, so it thinks it owns feminism. So when there's a shift in feminism, the left shift along with it. I don't know if that's right, but there has been this move from like being critical of yeah, patriarchal structures that would encourage a woman to think she needs breast implants to this like very consumerist looking choice narrative, kind of like Mark was invoking earlier on, right? That like, well, if this person wants this thing, there's like an autonomy based reason to do this thing, why not like just go with that? I think I would say that like the mainstream feminist position now on the left is just like whatever somebody wants, yay them. And that's very uncritical of the reasons why they end up wanting it. Why are women doing sex work? Why are they having OnlyFans accounts? Why are they half naked on Instagram and so on?
I certainly don't want to speak for feminism or for feminists or anything like that. But it's at least an open question, right? Whether going to a surgeon or going to a doctor to change your body to conform with gender norms, it's at least an open question whether that is a kind of left-wing thing to do rather than criticizing the sort of social structures that make those preferences, that generate those preferences. And you know, so it's not obviously right-wing, right?
Oh, no, agreed. Yeah, I think I'm just getting confused about like, What is like old left versus new left, and then what is like left versus right? And I think just maybe that is like quite conceptually confusing because the left seems to have changed a lot. So it's not that I would say that it's a right wing thing now to criticize social structures. It's just that I think maybe that's fallen out of the left a bit, and that might be why we don't see it so much in the trans debate either.
Fair enough. So maybe I should have answered your question about my politics by saying I'm old left.
Old left, yeah.
So if I understand it, there's a claim that going on puberty blockers is very useful for dealing with dysphoria. What does the evidence look like for that claim, and are there any concerns with it?
So as I mentioned earlier, the systematic reviews that have been conducted in Finland and the UK and Sweden suggest that the evidence that puberty blockers or cross-sex hormones are effective in improving mental health is really uncertain. And to find evidence that it's effective, you have to look at lower forms of evidence, individual studies, and so on. And one of the best places to look, and one of the set of papers that is cited by WPATH and cited by every guideline, are the two seminal studies coming out of the Netherlands that form the backbone of what's now known as gender-affirming care. And this was a study involving initially 70 youth who were provided, they were screened. And so if they had psychiatric comorbidities, they were excluded from the study. And then those who were included would receive puberty blockers at Tanner stage 2. And then they would move on to cross-sex hormones and then genital surgery at the age of maturity, at the age of 18 in the Netherlands. And one of the most striking findings from these two studies, the first published in 2011 by Annelou de Vries and her team, and the second in 2014, showed a drastic reduction in gender dysphoria, that is, serious discomfort arising as a result of gender incongruence. And people have looked at these two studies. It was on the basis of the data that the Dutch were collecting that the American clinic in Boston opened in 2006, 2007. They had already been collecting, they had preliminary data. The Finns opened their clinic, I want to say in 2011, around that time, because these studies seem to be show very promising results. So with respect to gender dysphoria in particular, what some researchers found recently in examining and analyzing these studies, in reading these studies, they were something puzzled them, right? So this was a paper that came out by Zhenya Abruzzese, Julia Mason, and Stephen Levine. They noticed that the psychological measures of psychological function and health, there was some improvement. It was mixed. Some things improved, some didn't. And where it improved was fairly modest. But dysphoria seemed to have been resolved entirely. It's a really dramatic finding. And they were trying to understand why you saw such a dramatic improvement in dysphoria, but only modest improvements and mixed improvements with the other variables. And in the peer review process, going back and forth with reviewers, and the reviewers seemed to know a whole lot about these papers, it was pointed out that the scale that they used to measure dysphoria, is called the Utrecht Gender Dysphoria Scale, was flipped between pre and post. So you should be able to see here on the screen an example where questions were given to a patient, let's say who's female, right? And for example, I prefer to behave like a boy, or I feel unhappy because I have to behave like a girl. And so if a dysphoric female patient fills these out, she's going to score very high when she's filling out the female form, right? Because she's expressing her discomfort with living as a girl or being a girl. This patient would have gone on blockers, cross-sex hormones, and then had genital surgery as an adult at 18. At that point, instead of giving the same scale, they would give her the male scale. So there you have questions like, I dislike having erections. Well, she's going to score very low on having erections, on disliking having erections, for reasons that are pretty obvious. My life would be meaningless if I would have to live as a boy, question one. She's going to score very low on that. And so what you end up with is, before treatment, very high gender dysphoria, and after treatment, very low gender dysphoria. But of course, this is just an artifact of the flipping of the scale. You could have asked her to fill out the male scale after you burn some incense, right? And you would get the same result, because she's being asked how she likes to be perceived, whether she likes to be perceived as a boy rather than a girl. And of course she does, because she identifies as a boy. So the groundbreaking result, right, there where the so-called gender affirmative model was able to resolve dysphoria, looks to be entirely based on an artifact of the way the scale was actually applied, rather than, right, measuring a psychological outcome, a real psychological change. So this is just an example, when you start to look at some of these studies, of how weak some of the evidence is. And again, these two studies form the evidentiary backbone of this treatment regime as it's practiced all over the world. Was that clear enough?